Committee on House Business and Labor, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2250.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we first heard House Bill 2250 on January 4th. This is from the OLCC. It makes technical corrections to statutes related to the Commission's distillery license, as well as related provisions related to brewery, public house, and winery licensure. It also clarifies that an appointed distillery retail outlet can have interest in a distillery. We were waiting on a fiscal impact analysis before we could work the bill, in which there is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
We were waiting. Now we do.
Yes, we have votes.
I have not heard anybody's hair on fire on this. Any comments, questions, concerns? We have the department here. If anyone on the committee would like to ask any questions on this bill, I will entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2250 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2250 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Okay, what I just said all over again. Any comments? Concerns? Is there any objection to this bill among the committee today? And Representative Thatcher is excused, so just put that on. All right, we've seen no objections, so would someone like to carry this bill on the floor? Representative Cameron, would you like to carry this bill on the floor?
Sure.
Is this a consent agenda bill?
Well, it has to do with liquor.
Yeah.
I guess you're right.
Thank you.
All right. Very good. Representative Cameron. Carry it, and I'm going to close the session. House Bill 2250. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2044. Teresa, you want?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2044 prohibits an employer or insurer from directing or requiring an injured worker to obtain non-emergency medical services from a specified provider. The measure also exempts an employer or insurer that has a managed care organization contract and authorizes the DCBS to impose civil penalties of up to $2,000 for each violation.
Thank you. I'd like to call Dr. Vern Sabo and Mr. Schultz from Workers' Comp Department, please. Doc, if you're ready, whichever one of you agreed to go first, go right ahead and start.
I'll go ahead.
Thank you.
For the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Vern Sabo representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. Is this on?
Yes, I believe it is.
Oh,
okay.
House Bill 2044 is relative to a continuing problem of employers, some employers, and we're not saying a lot, and we're not even saying a majority, we're saying some employers and some insurers, for lack of a better term, some rogue claims representatives, telling injured workers where they must go for treatment, that they must go here, they must go there. As you'll see in my presentation, the current statutory language specifically states that the injured worker gets to choose their provider, their doctor, not the employer, not the insurer, not anyone else. Department has acted on that, and in your booklet you have one official sanction by the division, the compliance division, relative to that. As I'll present, there is also an opportunity for an administrative rule, which would probably go a long way to fix the problem. What we're proposing with House Bill 2044 is to inject language that currently does not exist, that clarifies and codifies the current intent and interpretation of statutory language that says the injured worker gets to choose. Except that it's authorized by subsection 4 of this section, an employer or insurer may not direct or require the worker to obtain non-emergency medical services from a specific doctor, physician, nurse practitioner, occupational medical clinic, which is generally the case, emergency care clinic, or other medical group. It clarifies that the injured worker, in fact, gets to choose. This is current statutory language, again, which simply states that the injured worker gets to choose their doctor. And the interpretation, as I say, from the division is currently that employers, insurers, or anyone else is prohibited from telling an injured worker where they must go for treatment. However, the problem continues, I believe it's due to a very specific loophole in administrative rule, which I'll discuss in a minute. And again, by and large, where the injured workers are being directed or required to go is the local occupational medical clinic, urgent care centers, a particular doctor, or the quote-unquote company doc or company nurse. We have examples of that in your booklet. Sometimes under intimidation of possibly losing their job, and as we say, this is a minority, it's not the majority of employers, but it's a continuing problem. The other...
Yes. How long is your presentation this morning?
It is 240 slides. Is that a... No, I'm just kidding. No, it's just a couple of minutes. It's
okay,
nine slides.
Go ahead, then.
Ten
Here
slides. One of the other things is mandatory drug testing post-injury, which is appropriate, and employers can enforce this. But that's testing. It's not treatment. And what we're seeing is once the employee is sent to the OCMED Center for drug testing, they are never informed of their treatment rights, and once captured are never released, never told that, in fact, they can go to the provider of their choice. So I have a booklet here which we believe is an example of emails and letters from across the state that we believe, at least respectfully believe, that shows that, in fact, this is a valid problem. This was clarified as per no one can select an injured worker's provider or doctor, that, in fact, that's the current interpretation statute that the injured worker gets to choose. This is a letter, because of this problem, sent out by Mr. John Schultz, sitting to my right, Director of the Workers' Comp Division in March of 2007, clarifying this, I think, went out to some 90,000 stakeholders, I think, employers, providers, carriers. It simply states, under Oregon law, no one may require an injured worker to obtain treatment from a specific provider or type of provider. Now, because of this problem, several months ago, a task force was put together to rewrite all of the literature that went to injured workers to clarify their treatment rights. This is the booklet that goes to injured workers, supposedly provided by the insurer. There's no requirement for the insurer to provide this booklet unless there's a disabling claim, unless there's time loss. On page 6 of this document, it clearly states your employer cannot choose your health care provider. And on page 7, it simply states to the injured worker, you get to choose. Trouble is, in our opinion, some of these documents are simply not getting to the injured worker. And I'll discuss why in just a second. This is a form that we developed and improved on. It reads like a Miranda Act. It's form 3283, which is very critical. This clearly simply states in lay terms to the injured worker what their treatment rights are, not the least of which is bullet number 4 that simply states, get medical treatment from the health care provider of your choice. In the last sentence, your employer cannot choose your health care provider for you. It was assumed by many that, in fact, there was a requirement by the employer to provide that document to all injured workers at the time of injury. That is not the case. What current administrative rule actually says is that the employer is to provide Form 801 to the employee upon request. So the employee has to know that this form exists. Well, the trouble with that is that most injured workers, especially if it's their first work comp injury, have no idea when they go into their employer's office and report an injury. They have no idea what their rights are under current law and administrative rule, let alone know that this form exists. So they don't know to request it. We believe that that's a loophole that some, and I say some, a minority of employers are exploiting. Now, what's key to that is that what administrative rule says about Form 3283, which is the form that clearly states their treatment rights, not the least of which is they can go to the doctor of their choice, and their employer cannot ship them off to the OCMED Center. They get to choose. Is that administrative rule states that the insurer must provide Form 3283 to the employer with the Form 801. Well, if they don't get the Form 801, they're not getting this form that clearly states their treatment rights. That completes my testimony, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And simply put, one real big, easy, non-rocket science fix, and I think Ms. Shelton discussed this, is an administrative rule that would simply require an employer to provide both Form 801 and Form 3283 at time of report of claim on the same day.
And I support that type of rule. Mr. Schultz, explain to us how you're going to do that.
Excuse me, could I ask
Yes, Representative Cameron.
In looking through the bill, it says regarding non-emergency. Why did you select only non-emergency?
Well, simply if there's a life-threatening condition injury, then they should be, they have to, the employer has to be free to life flight them, take mm-hmm. them by ambulance. If it's a life-threatening emergency situation, then they can't have their hands tied.
They can steer it.
Yes.
Just looking at it a little differently. Thank you.
Mr. Schultz, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm John Schultz, the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I appreciate the opportunity, excuse me, to provide information to you. Basically, this bill was presented to the Management Labor Advisory Committee in December, and MLAC did not take action in form of a recommendation to you on the bill, and there were concerns expressed by members of the committee. However, none of the concerns were about providing notice of the workers' rights. Dr. Sabo's correct in saying that we support the idea that the workers need to be notified of their rights and have clear information and knowledge that they get to choose their treating provider. So very quickly, what we suggest doing is providing by administrative rule that the worker is provided notice of their rights on the forms that are already provided to the worker at the time that they make it known that they're seeking medical treatment, or at the time the employer provides the forms that they are required to provide now, the 801 form, as Dr. Sabo mentioned. There's also the form 827, which is a notice of claim form that could be provided by the physician, who might be the first one to recognize that the worker is actually in need of filing a claim. In both of those instances, I think we can make it very clear to the worker that only the worker has the right to choose their own treating provider, as well as to continue educational efforts with employers and our regulatory efforts as well. So it would be taking action on three fronts. One would be new, providing new administrative rule language, requiring notice of explanation of the rights on the forms that are already provided to the workers. I think one advantage to this is it doesn't require employers to produce another form necessarily. We could put the rights on the existing forms that are provided. Secondarily, continue education efforts with employers. Most employers that we contact in regard to this issue, we're acting out of ignorance and agree not to do this sort of activity. When the employer, and it's really, really rare, when we get an employer who's stubborn about that, then the next step, the third action, would be to take a regulatory action, which would include a penalty or a sanction to the employer. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Schultz. Doctor, it's apparent we're not going to work this bill today. I'm confident the department can work this out by rule. We will be revisiting it again in the interim to see where you're going, or possibly in January or February, when I'm sure we'll be back in this building anyway. With that, are any questions of these gentlemen? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vernon, your handout here.
Yes.
I'm about halfway through, just thumbing through it quickly, and I noticed that there's one provider clinic that, whose name seems to come up repeatedly. Is there any reason for concern that there may be some kind of communications going on between employers who may incorrectly suggest that their employees go to specific providers and one or two providers that appear to be part of the problem, possibly?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Witt, I'm not aware that there is. Okay. What we're seeing is, quite frankly, is and what you may be referring to is that I basically asked colleagues if there's patients. There's several of them that were willing to testify. You know, give me your stories. Many of the injured workers were afraid to file a complaint with the investigations and sanctions for fear of losing their job. I wanted to be anonymous, and when I asked for doctors to give examples, sometimes they would send in three or four at one time.
Mm-hmm.
But again, many of these complaints are he said, she said. It's a situation where the employer, the very few, as John said, that knowingly are, quite frankly, violating the current law.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is in writing. And so it's a situation when the investigator calls that employer. The employer says, oh, no, we didn't tell them they had to go there. We suggested, we recommended. And, of course, the injured worker says, no, they said I had to go there. It was company policy. And so there's no way to validate who is telling the truth. So the investigators left with their hands tied. They can't really act. So,
please, Representative.
So you're not seeing a pattern of providers suggesting that they be the preferred provider for injuries that occur?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Whip, members of the committee, to answer your question very specifically, the occupational medical centers have done a very good job of marketing themselves to the employers.
Okay.
And to the extent where, in fact, many of the employers, as Mr. Schultz indicated, just assumed that they could direct them there. So.
Thank you very much.
Representative Kennemer, then Representative Esquivel.
Mr. Schultz, trying to remember back, it seems to me that it's been the policy of the state for at least 20, 25 years that we don't have steerage. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair.
By state law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kennemer, I don't know the exact number of years, but I agree. It's been the law for quite some time.
Yeah, I guess, you know, some of this comes from my having served in the previous century, and I guess I think back about this, and I guess I'd like to know why the department hasn't enforced the regulation. I mean, it is the law, and I guess an administrative loophole doesn't sound to me like following the law.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kennemer, I think the department has been enforcing the law. The fact of the matter is we do get complaints about this issue, but not many. As Dr. Sabo pointed out, of the complaints, and I can give you facts in terms of the numbers, of the complaints that we do get, very often there's not sufficient information to identify the worker. There's not sufficient sufficient information to follow up with any sort of investigation that's going to garner much to act on. So we get information that's partial. Many of the complaints that we do get information on that we are able to follow up on, the majority of them we find are unfounded complaints. And I think Dr. Sabo is correct. Some of those are based on the worker deciding they don't want to pursue the complaint against their employer. However, when we are able to establish a complaint as validity, or if there is what's important to us in terms of our process today is if we can establish a pattern of abuse, we certainly will act from an enforcement perspective on those.
Representative Escobar.
Forgive me, Doctor. Go right ahead.
Representative Kinnamir, members of the committee, I'd like to respond also by saying the rationale that there's no complaints. Another piece of that is if you ask the average worker on the street, even the average injured worker, what DCBS stands for, or even Department of Consumer Business Services, Workers' Comp Division, do you know their phone number, where they're at? And one step further removed from that is the Investigations and Sanctions Unit. Do you know their phone number and the investigator? Above and beyond the fact that these injured workers are frightened as heck to lose their jobs, they don't know who the heck to complain to. They have no idea who to call. And so I think that's part of the not getting complaints is they have no clue who to complain to, any recognition that these agencies exist, or where they're at, or how to contact those agencies. So I think that's part of the problem.
Wait, before I go to my friends, which begs the question, will the phone number be on this form? Who to call if there is some kind of direction or pushing or steerage from the employer? Will that be on the form?
Mr. Chair, that's certainly something we could put on the
form. I would think that would be a great idea. And staple a card check card to it, too. Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that 30, 40 years, we've been instructed as employers to make sure that the employee understood what their rights were with a workman's comp claim, and I'm kind of surprised that to this day that still hasn't caught on to all people. Because I remember the company I worked for back in the early 70s, that if we had an injured worker, whether that be, you know, of course, a non-emergency, there's a difference between someone getting their thumb cut off and somebody having a sliver in it, that they were, in fact, told of their rights, that they had that ability to go anywhere they wanted to get the sliver out. Now, of course, if they had their thumb cut off, you immediately took them to the emergency care unit. But I guess I'm surprised. Hasn't that been in law for forever?
Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, yes, it's been the law for quite some time. And it's based on the amount of complaints that we get, which is actually quite small. And some of that may be because of what Dr. Sabo describes, that some workers don't know where to complain. However, we think most employers are complying with the law and doing not acting in a manner that's out of compliance with the law. However, there's always new employers. There's employers who may change their practices. It's a constant, there's a constant need to educate both the employer and the worker about the worker's rights, not only in this area, but in many other areas as well, so that the worker's rights aren't violated. But I would not suggest that employers in mass numbers are not complying with this law. The evidence suggests the contrary. Employers do comply.
Follow up. Please, Representative.
Well, it appears, though, that there's a few that these are mostly 08s, I believe. Well, I guess they go back as far as 06, but that's quite a number of them. What's interesting is the mentality of some of these people. On his boss told him he had to go see a real doctor first. I'm amazed at that mentality, but obviously it's still around and active. I would like to suggest that if you do something of this nature, obviously it's not catching on to some people. Maybe you should also, with your 801, when you fill it out, which I thought we were required to within 24 hours, if my memory serves me correct, that maybe you give people a list of rights, of employee rights sheet as well.
Mr. Chair, can I respond?
Please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, members of the committee, again, they're not required to give them the 801, only if the injured worker knows to request it. And there lies the rub. the injured worker, that's the loophole in administrative rule, which I think has fueled some of this steering, is that, in fact, the employer does not have to give the injured worker the 801 unless they request it. Now, many of them do, and a couple of members of the AMLAC committee, Sherry Sundstrom from Hoffman Construction, and Kathy, I'm going to probably say your name wrong, Nishimoto from
Duckwall Pool
Fruit Company in Hood River assumed that they were supposed to give and were required to give the 801 at time of injury. That's not the case. In fact, Kathy said she posts them in their lunchroom. Well, those companies do it right. This isn't about those types of companies. So, again, having an administrative rule that would require the employer to present the injured worker with an 801 at the time of injury and on the backside printed Form 3283, which tells clearly their rights, not the least of which is they get to choose, their employer does not, would go a long way to solve the problem.
And once again, members, we're not going to move this bill. That's exactly what the department's going to do, and I'm confident they're going to, and we're going to follow up on it, and if they don't, we're going to revisit this again. And I think what Dr. Sabo just spelled out is prudent, is fair, is reasonable, and I'm confident we can accomplish this without the bill. That does not mean I'm not willing to return to it as long as I'm chair of this committee and pursue it if we... I think the vast majority of people in the state want to comply with the law. As a government, I think it's our job to make sure they know what the law is, and that they. And then I believe most people are willing to comply. And for those bustards out there that don't, well, then we put the hammer down on them. And that's a pretty simple philosophy for me. Mr. Cameron?
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr.'s fine.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because I call you Mr.
Well, right, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Couple concerns I have. Obviously, I'm glad we're not going to move this bill because as an employer, the term direct would be very, very gray, knowing a restaurant environment as I do, and somebody gets hurt, and even if I was required to give them the 801 form or say to them at that point in time, you know, you can go anywhere you want to. Here's where we recommend that you go because you're going to get timely service. We know we can get you in. We can get you taken care of. So I think we need to be very, very cautious in putting words like direct in here. That would cause an employer now all of a sudden to be in a violation of something when we're trying to take care of our employees. The ones that are doing it right, we don't need to penalize all of them. And the other thing I want to say that the department obviously is doing a good job of bringing it to people's attention because right in Mr. Sabo's, the front page of Mr. Sabo's complaints is an example where Chevy's restaurant has... did not do it the right way and obviously has been fined or attempted to be fined $2,000 as a result of the actions taken by the department. So I want to compliment the department in bringing it to people's attention that are not doing it the right way.
Which leads me to a question. Is what an employer would think a friendly recommendation, can that be interpreted as direction currently under the law?
Mr. Chair, that and Representative Cameron, I this issue about no clear definition of direct or require was raised at MLAC, and of course that does bring up an issue that this bill would require us to deal with. And Mr. Chair, in answer to your question, certainly. It occurs where an employer may think they're doing something the right way, not providing you must or you shall go here, but hey, we've had really good experience with this clinic or whatever, and we highly recommend it. That the worker, on the other hand, could experience that as direction. And report that as direction. In many of the complaints that we follow up on, we find that as Dr. Sabo pointed out, there's a he said, she said phenomenon that occurs there. And as we follow up on the investigations, in many of these cases where, and again, there's not many cases here, but in several or a large percentage of the cases, the workers are found not to have a valid complaint.
I'm not a lawyer, but I would, if I were, I'd recommend my clients not to make any recommendation, just to avoid any misinterpretation of this.
Mr. Chair, if I may just add one other thing. The statute, the way it's written now, is written from, rather than saying you may not do this, what the statute does is provide clearly that the worker may choose. And we have tried to follow that lead, although we have added information to some of our publications, most recently in educational efforts, directly on the other side. You may not require workers, and no one may require a worker, and those sorts of statements.
You know what I would like you to do is, as you're drafting this language in the department, to email it to us and share it with us throughout, whether it's in the interim or not, so we can look at it among ourselves and individually. And maybe weigh in on it, since if anything does happen in the future, it'll come right, on all likelihood, right straight through this committee anyway.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to do that. We, of course, go through a public administrative rules process, and so that can easily be accommodated.
Thank you very much. Representative Kanemer, then Representative Holvey.
Do you have a website where injured workers can turn for information where this issue is dealt with?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kanemer, yes, we have a website, and it does contain information about this. However, it contains a lot of other information as well. A worker...
I can imagine it's voluminous. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here, but this is an important point, because a lot of people want to go where they need to go.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Representative Kanemer, you're absolutely right. There's some basic areas where violations occur. One of the most fundamental is an employer trying to prevent a worker from filing a claim. That's a very fundamental violation. But this is also what we would call in the area of a fundamental violation. We don't see the numbers of these types of violations that we do in some of the other areas, but you're right, this is a fundamental area. Workers need to know that they can choose their treatment provider.
Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real briefly, in listening to this, it seems to me that even though we don't see a lot of complaints or they haven't been substantiated, it seems kind of a stretch for me because, frankly, a worker is in a pretty precarious position to try to pursue a complaint around this, and how would you substantiate it? I don't think that's really a good judge of whether or not there's a problem out there, and frankly, just because of the unsuredness of the word direct, I think that's, could be worked out and rule what direct means. If I were to vote on this bill right now, I'd vote for it because I quite frankly don't think this bill is overreaching at all. I think it quite clearly states what the law should be, and it's been that way for 20 years, and I am a little troubled by this issue because I think the worker is at an extreme disadvantage in these cases, and I think they should be given the benefit of the doubt in this situation, and it bothers me to think that people are not getting the care they deserve. Thank you.
Representative, I agree with everything you just said, and we're going to give the department a chance to deal with this. And if they don't, that's exactly what I intend to do, what is push this through, because I share my friend's concern about the interpretation or definition of direction, but I think we could clarify that in language. But we're going to give you the opportunity to take care of this. And then I'm going to Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chair, may I
please go ahead.
Respond to that? I don't want to leave, Mr. Chair and Representative Holvey, I don't want to leave the committee with the impression that somehow this issue's been ignored over the years by the department. The facts are that we get very few complaints in this area. When we get complaints, we investigate every single one of those complaints. We maintain records on the employers, whether or not we find that the complaints are valid or not, in order to determine if there's a pattern of abuse going on out there. And when we find that a complaint is valid, we act either by trying to educate the employer and then following up to ensure that their practices are appropriate, or with employers that are recalcitrant or stubborn about changing their practices, we come forward with sanctions for those employers. We don't have a disagreement here. We believe that workers need to know their rights explicitly. The last thing I would say is we've been working on this issue. We've been trying to educate workers and employers, and we have already been working, as Dr. Sabo pointed out, with Dr. Sabo and other stakeholders to put more clear, direct language in front of workers about this issue. I would say one of the challenges that we have is there are a great many interests for workers at stake, and we tend to provide workers with large amounts of notice already, and there isn't anything in this particular publication that Dr. Sabo mentioned that isn't important for the worker to know. So it is possible that these kinds of things can get lost. It can get lost in terms of all the information that the worker has provided. That does not mean that the department has not been working on this, nor that we don't take this seriously. We take this very seriously.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to echo my support for what, or I want to echo what Representative Holvey said about the precarious position that this puts the worker in. I absolutely believe that. I'm not saying that the department doesn't do a good job of enforcement, but there's no doubt in my mind that a worker doesn't necessarily want to push it with in their work environment with their boss. And what is striking to me about this entire hearing thus far is that I see in this packet example after example of SAFE and Liberty Northwest being accused as being the agents that are steering and that are informing workers that they have to go to one doctor or one provider in particular. And I haven't heard those names even mentioned in this hearing. And so, I mean, I'm interested in perspective there, because I'm hearing that employers probably just maybe acting out of ignorance. Maybe they just don't know, not necessarily malice of intent, but there's no question that the insurance underwriters absolutely know what the law is. And so if there's a lack of enforcement, you know, we're not talking about that, and I'm interested in hearing a little bit about it.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to respond if I could. Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, members of the committee, we're of the opinion. We do not believe this is the opposite, the protocol for Safe Corporation or Liberty Northwest to facilitate the directing or requiring injured workers treat with specific provider types. We truly believe this is just the individual claims representative, rogue claims representative, if you will, that takes it upon themselves to do so at a certain point in a conversation with a injured worker. I don't believe that's the protocol of SAFE nor Liberty Northwest. In fact, SAFE Corporation, the lobbyist Chris Davies made the point in MLAC that, in fact, when SAFE sends out the 801, they print Form 3283 on the backside of the 801. So I don't believe that it's SAFE, Liberty Northwest. I think it's just small outliers, in this case, claims representatives, that take it upon themselves to do this activity. And again, I think it's rare within those two companies.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I would just also add that because of the way the market is concentrated here in Oregon, that Liberty Northwest and Safe Corporation have the vast majority of the market. So typically complaints are going to center there. What we do find, and we've had some conversations with the Ombudsman's Office, is though while those two insurers get a lot of the complaints directed at them, when you actually look at the percentages as compared to their market share, they have a lower percentage of complaints to their market share. There are 200 other insurance companies underwriting workers' compensation insurance in Oregon. As the person who is responsible for the regulation of those insurers, it's been my experience that Safe and Liberty are a lot easier to work with, frankly, than out-of-state insurers who don't have as much information about Oregon. Typically, they make less mistakes. Typically, we find higher levels of compliance with both those insurers.
Well, I appreciate that clarification, but it should be noted that even if it is a rogue agent, those companies are responsible for the actions of their agents. So,
Mr. Chair,
but I do appreciate that clarification.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I agree with you completely. And again, I do not believe that we are in disagreement here. If this activity is going on and we can demonstrate it, we will definitely take action. And you are right. The worker very well may be in a position that they do not want to endanger themselves and pull back. And we agree that's an issue, I think, that's just inherent in this in this area of regulation. So one of the things that we rely heavily on is getting the information out to all the parties from the positive perspective that the worker is in the position to make the choice as greatly as we can.
Representative Escobar.
Yes, I'm pretty confident that SAFE and insurance companies themselves do not steer people in this manner. I really don't. I think that it's a broad brush approach. It's kind of like when somebody gets in a TIF that's down at DMV, it's automatically our fault, the government. So it's you're all guilty. And I think that's what's going on here, because I know you don't usually talk to SAFE at all unless you have something clerical going on with your claim. So am I correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, SAFE's level of performance on our compliance audits are typically of the highest order.
Okay, any further questions of this panel? And we are going to be watching it, and I support this concept, and I'm confident you can take care of it, and you're going to keep us up to speed on what's going on, correct?
That would be correct, Mr. Chair. I am also confident that we can continue to take care of this, as well as continue to make changes, positive changes, in the administrative rules that will help us make progress in this area. And yes, we will keep you and the entire committee informed of our progress.
And I'd like to see that form number on that form, questions, concerns, or complaints put right on that form.
Mr. Chair, that can easily be done, and it can be provided on other forms as well.
Great. All right. Thank you very much. Anyone else want to testify on this bill today? All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2044, and I'm going to open a work session for the purposes of making two bill drafts into bills, and I would entertain a motion.
Why don't we just say the bill draft?
Mr. Chair, do you want me to explain?
Why don't you explain what we're doing here, Teresa, as always?
Mr. Chair, committee members, we have two bill introductions today. LC 3252 relating to education collaboration, and this is actually on behalf of the Subcommittee on Workforce Development, and LC 2587 relating to pre-qualifications for public contracts.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move the committee accept LCs 3252 and 2587 as committee bills.
Representative Barton moves that we accept legislative concepts 3252 and 2587 as committee bills. And once again, members, just for the record, this in no way, shape, or form commits you to voting yes or no on any of these drafts. All we're doing here is a procedural vote to make these into bills. Is there any questions, concerns, or opposition to this motion? Seeing none, so moved. I'll close. Okay. I'll close the work session. And anything for the good of the order? Seeing nothing,